Oh, well. Yeah, because of food safety and whatever. Yeah. Well, it's like the farmer's market. It's crazy. A big day today. Turn my light on, get going here.
Where's Steve Moore? Is he?
Okay. Good morning. I don't know. Are we all right on the mic this morning? It's like church. We only got the left wingers and not the right wingers or whatever, all on one side. So we're okay back there, Mr. Recorder. So all of you know me bright and early in the morning coming to Oakland. And I've been trying, you know, to think the last few days during the drought what kind of a opening remark I would have, and I had nothing. I'm like, oh, I'm blank. They're losing faith too many years. So I get over here at 6:30, the garage opens up, and I go to coffee, and one of the 99 percenters, you know, confronted me and smelled like one, too. And so I said, hey, you got a fancy coat. You must be a one percenter. I said, no, it's my daughter, who works 15 hours a day, is a one percenter, so she bought it for me. So that was the first thing. And number two, we got talking, and I said, well, you know, I'm a small farmer also, you know, and we're facing some serious water issues. And I said, you know, my puppy piddles more water than we've had in the last 6 months. Oh, really, you poor guy, that's too bad. And finally, I said, you know, I've been serving on this wonderful Regional Water Quality Control Board for 16 years this year, and haven't gotten a raise in 16 years either. And he goes, I better buy your coffee. So there's my story. I swear to goodness, every time you think you're out of a story, come to Oakland. Let me tell you, you get a story in Oakland. So other than that, we better have roll call, please, and introductions after.
Here.
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 Introductions. I believe we have a couple. Please come forward. And I have one, too, today.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Johnson, but I'm not here to introduce myself. I present to you today perhaps one of the rarest of species, a new water board employee. One of our first in 2.5 years. Dylan Garner here has a bachelor's in science in civil and environmental engineering with an emphasis in water resources from UC Davis, which he got last year. More importantly, he started swimming at age 2 and claims to have been obsessed with water ever since. And I suspect that his obsession will still soon turn to wastewater, as everyone else in the NPDES wastewater world has. Now, he doesn't mention this often, but he also has a degree in psychology, which we're hoping to put to good use, so we finally seek to better understand Bruce. Dylan lives in Vallejo with his partner Marcy, 2 dogs, and a tuxedo kitty, and they all hope to move to Oakland soon to be closer to all of us. So, welcome, Dylan.
Chairman Muller, members of the board, it's with great pleasure that I introduce Javier Fernandez, the Watershed Division's newest employee. Javier is an environmental scientist with a master's in environmental management from the University of San Francisco. Javier brings more than 11 years of wetland monitoring, habitat evaluation, and risk assessment to the board. Javier is no stranger. He's been working with us as an ABAG employee, and you may recall last year he brought the Lower Crystal Springs Dam Improvement Project, as well as the Calaveras Dam Replacement Project, to the board's attention. And you may recall his infamous analogies of the martini glass and the margarita glass describing slopes associated with reservoirs and how vegetation can reestablish in certain areas and not. But we're very fortunate to have Javier, and my pleasure to introduce him.
Thank you. That's great news. And if I may quickly, I think what we adults have all learned the value of getting involved in serving and stepping up, as we all do, even though we haven't gotten an increase in salary in many, many years. But today we have a special young man here named Michael Lee. And Michael, would stand up, please, and we'll get into your little quick introduction here. Is a senior at Irving High School in Fremont, and he is taking the initiative to step forward to learn more about water quality and pollution in the bay, and he's been sacrificing his spare hours to learn more about this. And he belongs to a Quest program, and his main topics have been water quality and bay issues, and so we're really proud of him. He is also an applicant at that big red school down the coast that lost, or down the peninsula that lost the bowl game. But we're hoping he can get into Stanford, but he's applied for many colleges, and I'm sure with the energy and effort he's put into his whole life of education, he'll get into a great school. So we welcome you and thank you. He's going to sit in on the meeting today to learn more how we all work together and do what's best for water quality in the Bay Area. So, Michael, congratulations, and I wish you well. And hopefully someday you'll be standing over here with all your fancy degrees and get a job here, too. Thank you. And at this time, January, it'll be my honor to pass the chairship over to for nominations to the vice chair. Dr. Young, please.
Yes, thank you. I think, is this on? I think, yes. I'm called the presiding officer. So I would like to open the floor for nominations for the chairmanship of the regional board for this coming year, and do something a little bit different, which is jump to the front of the line because it's my prerogative, and I would like to nominate Chairman Mueller for another year. But I am
We don't need seconds,
actually.
That's true.
Yeah, so I'm looking at my instructions here, and I'm supposed to leave ample time for other nominations. So here's the beginning of ample time.
First, I would like to say that I would like to second the nomination of John Mueller because he has a pleasant personality. He always tells nice jokes at the beginning of the meeting, and he gets along with everybody. So I like the creativity of his, so I second him.
I think that's the end of ample time. So I would like, please, to have a roll call vote.
Mr. Eliano?
Aye.
Yes.
Dr. Kim?
Yeah. Yes.
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 You'd have had to do it even without your vote.
Yeah. Well,
you've now become the presiding officer.
Thank you, Vice Chair. It's interesting. Again, this is my 11th term. Don't ask me how I got here, but
we are so grateful to have Chairman Mueller to step up to the plate for one more year. He has a lot going on in his life, does it all so well and so graciously, and we all, those of you who were here at the last board meeting may have seen us, the rest of us, kind of whispering in the wings and dancing little jigs because we were sharing the news that he was willing to do it with us for another year. So we are really delighted.
Thank you. I'll recompose here a little bit, but it's truly a privilege and definitely an honor, and I don't know if we have broken any records here in California over water board chairs, but I deeply appreciate it. And I had the opportunity to speak last Wednesday to a fellowship group in Sacramento at UC Davis, and they were talking about chairing and how do we do it and things like that, and I said, you know, it's always great to be a chair when you have such a wonderful board. And so you've made life easier as a chair because of your expertise and your professionalism and your kindness to all. And so I appreciate that very much. And then the other part, which it started out earlier, I said there's times when you have a commenter that you don't say anything back. And so I almost felt that way earlier, as you could see. There was nothing I could say, so other than thank you, and we'll continue to hopefully do the best job for all of us here in the Bay Area and for the state. And we're going to run with it one more time. And I guess they'll get sick of seeing me in Sacramento, but that's their problem. So thank you all very much, and thank you, staff. And, Yuri, thank you for the details on how to properly run a nomination. And at this time, we will open nominations for vice chair.
If I might just comment, because it is really a pleasure to vote for John. And it's John may give credit to the board, but since I've been here, he's always set the tone, how we listen to each other and how we try to make sure that each person's viewpoint is expressed. And particularly as we are involved in things that affect agriculture, I think he reminds us and keeps us in mind that realizing the virtues of sustainability as one of the core values of agriculture needs to be part of our approach with agriculture and pretty much with everybody. So he can give us credit, but he really sets the tone, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Board Member Moore?
Yeah, all right. Congratulations. You have my full support, Chair Mueller. Thank you.
We appreciate it. So at this time, we will...
Can I make any remarks?
Yes, sir.
Okay. It's my pleasure already, but I would like to also say that I appreciate the graciousness of Terry Young. And she has been waiting in the wing as vice chair and has taken over the presidency or chairmanship from time to time when needed. And so she was very gracious. Thank you. I would like to wish everybody a happy new year because this is the first meeting after the new year. So from my side, maybe from all the board side, everybody, happy new year. Thank you.
Thank you. And at this time, we have a nomination for vice chair. And she's probably like myself. We're a team of chair and vice chair. And matter of fact, in February, I'll miss the February meeting, which I don't miss too many meetings other than maybe February and October. But nomination for vice chair.
Well, I would be so pleased to nominate Dr. Terry Young.
You need a second?
I will second it.
Well, we don't need a second, but it's nice to know that everybody agrees.
A roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliott?
Aye.
Mr. Mayor?
Aye.
Mr. Moore?
Aye.
Dr. Singh?
Aye.
Dr. Young?
Yes.
Yes, and before I let her say a couple words again, I don't think there's any of us that's ever been near Vice Chair Young, how wonderful and professional she is and how knowledgeable she is. And I'm kind of a highlighter, and she's kind of a little tab lady. And let me tell you, she tabs all those lines in there, and I'm sure you as staff and as our key staff knows, she'll let you know. And I mean, how valuable is that for all of us in the water world, and how valuable is that to this state of California that people really take the time to go through the details, which I rely on all her expertise at looking at these details. And it's just truly, again, a privilege to be sitting with such a great board, but with such a great vice chair, too. And there's nobody any better that we could ask for, and hopefully very soon she'll be running this whole deal here. So thank you, Vice Chair. Congratulations. You can say a couple words.
I'm speechless. It's an honor and a privilege, and I so much enjoy being a part of this board. I travel a lot, meet a lot of people. Whenever they say, well, what do you do? The first thing I mention is being a part of this board. And I'm always so proud to be associated with it. That has a lot to do with the staff. It has a lot to do with my fellow board members, as John said. It has a lot to do with John setting the tone as chair. And I appreciate this opportunity to be vice chair for another year. Thank you.
And you know, I think it's always handy to have the chair nearby to do the crying for you, too. So thank you. So at this time, we better move on after all these wonderful moments together. And so we will go to public forum, and I do not have any speaker's cards at this time. And we'll move on to the minutes of February 9th, the board meeting. Accept a motion to approve, please.
And move approval.
All seconded.
Moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. So ordered. And we will move on to the chair and board members' report. And I do have a very brief one here. So we did have a monthly chair call a week ago. And we actually had all nine chairs on the conference call, which was great. And so the typical appointments, a number of regions have accepted, received appointments, budget, and I'll let our executive officer, that's their area of expertise on budget. Legislation, they're not quite sure what's going on in Sacramento other than hopefully getting some tax bonds passed here soon. And we talked about a spring chairs meeting where we're going to actually get together face-to-face very soon. And I'm not sure if it's Gordon Burns or Mr. Burns is a new undersecretary of Cal EPA.
Yeah, Gordon.
And is it Gordon?
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure how that. And I don't know his background, but he is recently appointed as our undersecretary. I don't know in your report, Bruce, if you have any details on that. And so that's all I have as a board chair's call. And other board members? We'll start down here.
Serve as BCDC's representative of the Harbor Safety Committee, and we met last week. And one of the things that came up is something that I would appreciate if Bruce would cover in his discussion, and that's the problems with the metal refinishers or recyclers down in Redwood City, and the enforcement action by EPA. I'm always a little bit nonplussed when enforcement action comes from somewhere else other than the board. And I did talk a little bit with Deb Self from the Baykeeper, who sits on the committee. I think institutionally it raises for us the question of, are we always doing the right things? And do we end up so busy doing what we have to do that it's hard to take stock and step back and say, what is it we're not doing and we don't realize we should be doing. So it is that kind of thinking that we must rely on NGOs for. But it's also why sometimes I go out and meet with them and say, what should we be doing that we aren't? So I would like to hear Bruce's take on that, and that's all I have.
Shalom. Vice Chair Young, and I might add this whole thing down in Redwood City, if we remember correctly, a few months ago, the vice chair was the one that brought this to our attention, but in keeping a tradition, EPA took credit for it. So, Vice Chair Young.
Yeah, well,
should have been you on the front page instead of.
Some things don't change. Yes, I just wanted to report on the fact that I had a wonderful lunch with Jim McGrath and also John Coleman in December. Mr. Coleman, as most of you know, is chair of the Bay Planning Coalition. He's also on the East Bay MUD Board and was just recently elected to be chair of the East Bay MUD Board for the year. We talked about to some degree how various agencies, including ours, can incorporate the implications of sea level rise into our work. It was a brainstorming and free-ranging discussion, and I think we probably came up with every idea that anybody's ever had and made for a nice long lunch, and we had a very interesting discussion, but did note that this board is right in the middle of the intersection between the land and the sea, so we're going to have to deal with that issue, and hopefully we'll do it well. We also talked quite a bit about East Bay MUD and the challenges that they face financially, because we are all doing such a good job of decreasing demand for water and therefore paying less for it. And I've been told that this is a potential problem really across California, and particularly as we get better at not only conserving but recycling. So it was interesting for him to hear him say that the greatest decreases right now are from the municipal and industrial customers, which I didn't know. Anyway, very, very nice to hear the perspective of Mr. Coleman.
Board Member Singh?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say a small story over here because this is a happy occasion. And then I will tell you my concern. A young boy in New York City without shoe and any socks in the winter was just standing in front of a shoe store looking through the window, glass window. And he was shivering because the pavement was kind of cold. A lady came and she was passing by. She says, "Son, what are you looking at here? Are you not cold?" "Yes, yes, I'm cold. I'm just praying to God that if I would have one of those shoes, I'm looking at those shoes." So the lady took that boy inside the store and bought a shoe for her, for him, as well as she bought some 6 pairs of socks. She took in the bag, washed his feet, dried it with a towel, and put it on, and gave the 5 socks and she said, "Son, go and take it with you." And the lady started to leave the store, and the boy pulled the hand, and she turned around and said, "Son, what do you want now?" He said, "I just want to ask you a question." He said, "What is your question?" "Are you God's wife?" So doing sometimes a little favor is always good. I have so many things on my mind, but I would like to say that high pressure has been sitting on Utah and in Nevada and a couple of other high pressure in Kansas area has been stopping the flow of, you know, the low pressure region, and rain has not happened in this area. But I'd like to announce a good news over here, and I've been concerned, and my lawn and all my grass and plants have been drying, and I've been really watering and watering. And, you know, the cost of water is very high. And I said, "God, answer my prayers." So starting tomorrow, there is a prediction in the paper. The rain is going to occur, and all of us will cheer up. So thank you very much.
You have to remember, though, you get a retirement check, so it doesn't matter. You know, for me, I need to water my crops because I'm pumping water.
Pumping water is cheaper.
No, I don't know.
I'm from San Jose Water Company, I tell you that.
Board Member Moore.
Oh, thank you. My voice is a little off, so I'll keep my report very short. But I would say there's a flip side to the water story, which is I've got to dig a 25-foot pit. And the pipe was late, and so I wish the rain would wait another week. So there's always two sides to that equation. Thank you. Congratulations to Chair Mueller and Vice Chair Young for a well-deserved additional term. And I have a real privilege to serve on this board with their leadership, and I really appreciate my fellow board members as well. I wanted to... I know I talked about it last month, but you know, as Board Member McGrath brought up appropriate enforcement and the type of messages that this board should send, I'll bring us back to what's in our table of settled actions in this month's Executive Officer's Report and show you my little Xerox copy that I have of an actual red balloon with the advertisement. I was within 2 hours of this unfortunate event of the red balloon. My wife obtained one of these, and so I kept it as evidence in case you needed it. I also emailed Bruce within a couple hours of the event. So it's not just the NGOs that are out there. There's others of us that are keeping an eye on what's appropriate for protection of water quality. And then I don't really have much else to add. But that, you know, we really do appreciate the support of the NGOs in those regards, and they were right there behind me when I brought it to their attention as well. So thanks very much, and let's get on with the meeting.
Thanks, Steve. Bruce, please.
A few items, actually, and Steve's comments about the enforcement on the red balloon caper that has been settled for $7,000. So we do make use of board members reporting things they see, including Sims, and got copied recently on something from Jim. So it's always a challenge for us to have eyes and ears throughout the region. And so that's why we do, in many respects, coordinate with other agencies on enforcement. The Sims case is a case where EPA, partially because EPA has capabilities under the Clean Water Act to do certain levels of enforcement that are difficult, more difficult for us to do, they can take actions in some cases more efficiently than we can. On the flip side, we can do penalty actions under the state water code more efficiently than the federal government. So there is coordination in that regard. As was commented on, sometimes our role in these actions isn't always fully recognized. But in many respects, the challenge is to be moving forward with some level of progressive enforcement. In the Sims Metals case, they do have coverage under the industrial stormwater permit. That is a federal permit. So EPA was taking action. We have also done inspections there and coordinating with them moving forward and looking at whether there is appropriate need to do penalty action in that case. This is somewhat similar. You may remember a couple of months ago we reported on enforcement on the discharge of plastic pellets, the nurdles. And again, we are coordinating with US EPA on that and actually the State Water Board on that. And so there are a lot of opportunities. We have to get all of the eyes and ears keeping us abreast of what's out there, and local agencies and federal agencies too. We do have the opportunity because here in the Bay Area, we do have the US EPA Region 9 office. And so we have all of EPA's employees giving us input on things they see on a regular basis. So it is useful that we do have more eyes and ears because we can't do it all, but we then try to prioritize what the priorities for moving forward on the progressive enforcement and how we bring that forward. And I think we've been successful in doing so.
Bruce, I guess I'm a little curious as to the mechanics. I mean, the Sims plant is a metal recycler, and there are metal recyclers in the Port of Oakland, the Port of Portland, and it's a vital process by which we recycle metals. There are a number of others, and I guess when I see something like this, the technological question is: should they have? Is there authority for? Is it appropriate to require bag houses or coverage over the transport mechanisms that go over water, and what's done in other areas, what's best management practices? Those are the kinds of things that it triggers in my mind, because it's certainly not the only one. Recycling is an important part of sustainability. Are we thinking about what the technology should be? And because this doesn't fall in the kind of permits come in the door, applications come in the door. How do we get to think about these things with the kind of thinking that when your staff focuses on things, I'm already always very pleased with the results. The question is, what kind of escapes attention? So, can you talk a little bit about the
technology? Well, and it, as I say, it is a challenge because there's approximately in our region alone 1,800 facilities that are covered under the industrial stormwater permit, and they all are required to develop a stormwater pollution prevention plan and implement control measures. And the Sims facility in Redwood City is one that we have had enforcement on in the past. They're not the only one, as say, with a conveyor-type approach, and so it's what is the appropriate controls to ensure that materials aren't falling off conveyors. It's not only recycling facilities, as you note, Port of Oakland, there are facilities there that we are overseeing. We're looking at, Sims has another facility in Richmond that we're looking at. Other conveyor type operations are sand and gravel operations that we've looked at. And so it's trying to make sure that they're doing proper controls. But again, this is a case where with approximately 1,800 facilities where they don't have come back to us, like today you're hearing the individual permits, which we have to reissue every 5 years under the general permit, industrial general permit. They have the requirements, but each of those 1,800 doesn't come before you. They file for coverage, and we have to prioritize how we do follow-up. And so we've looked at things ranging from a lot of the what we would say the dirtier sand and gravel type facilities. Obviously, we are putting some emphasis on the plastic pellet nurdle facilities. Certainly, the Sims report made sure that we were looking at the other facilities that do use conveyors, because that is something that's should be relatively straightforward to control. Most facilities recognize they need to make those controls, and we thought, by and large, we are far past having situations where they were still having releases and discharges from those conveyors. And that's sort of the essence of EPA's action, is to make sure they bring those conveyors back up to a level where they're controlling that type of discharge. And so that's the same thing we're looking at the other facilities. Have they implemented those type of controls? If they have, are they maintaining them? Are they keeping them fully functional? And so that's the challenge. Further items, as Chair Mueller mentioned, we did have a proposed budget released by the governor a couple weeks ago. Our office, or the water boards as a whole, at one level have made out reasonably well. In other words, while there are some low-level cuts, there are things we anticipated. The tobacco fund, tobacco tax that was funding a small portion of our watershed management program is being pulled back. We knew that was coming. The timing was such that Dale Hopkins, who had been partially funded through that, has retired this past fall. So the work hasn't gone away. We can manage the fact that we don't have that funding, but we still have the work to do. That's a relatively small cut, and the State Board as a whole has had some cuts as the bond fund, that sort of ramps down from Prop 50, Prop 84. Some of that funding is reduced. That's all at State Board level. But under this administration, the approach has been taken essentially saying, here is your overall funding for your agency. Once you demonstrate that you can live within that funding, you can hire up to that level. And that's why, as we saw today, we've been able to do some hiring for the first time in 2.5 years, and we expect to be able to do 2 or 3 more positions in coming months. And we do not expect at this point that we would have anything such as furloughs or other work reduction programs in place. So we hope that we can establish some consistency and some expectation on what our level of funding is. Nonetheless, budget season is always a little bit up in the air, especially this being election year, that it's certainly not over in terms of budget until it's signed, which won't be until sometime in the summer. One of the things that was proposed in this budget is the governor's looking at opportunities to streamline or consolidate agencies, and as part of that, for the water boards, there's the proposal in there to reduce the number of board members from 9 to 7 for each of the boards, and to consolidate one of the regions, in this case the Colorado River region, into other regions. In other words, not necessarily get rid of the office, but reduce the actual boards. There's, for many years, been a sense at the in Sacramento that with nine regions and nine members on each region, 81 plus five on the state board, that over 80 positions to appoint and then have confirmation hearings on, that's too much of a burden, that the board system would operate just as efficiently, if not more so, with fewer members and potentially fewer boards. Nonetheless, that is something that requires legislation. That's not just something the governor can implement. And so the final shape of that will rely on the whole legislative process. There was an initial bill last year that considered some reductions, and it was a two-year bill, which means it can be brought back up. And so that's probably the vehicle. But this is something that wouldn't take place until a bill was adopted, signed by the governor, and then it would unless it was deemed to be an emergency, which I doubt it would be, it would take place January 1, 2013. So if there was a reduction in number of board members, we would expect at the same time that there would be some modification of the water code to indicate that a quorum would be a simple majority, four. Right now, the quorum is five. And so this board's been operating right now with six. We had up until last fall with seven, and that's a challenge when the quorum is five. So certainly we'd benefit if it was a quorum of four for a board of seven. But again, this is something that, because it needs to be driven by legislation, there's probably a lot of things that are going to move back and forth before something reaches the governor's desk. So, and just a reminder on the budget process that the governor puts out his proposed budget now, but it has to go through budget hearings at the legislature. There is, once new revenues analysis is done in May, then the governor has a chance to tweak his proposal and put out what's called the May revise, with the goal of the legislature approving a budget by June 15th and the governor signing it by June 30th in advance of the July 1 beginning of the fiscal year. As you know, that has happened very rarely. And again, this is, especially since it's an election year, you know, we can probably start the pool now as to when the budget might be signed. But there's a lot of steps between now and the budget being signed. But from what we've seen from the proposal, it looks like this agency is in good shape to move forward and continue our mission of water quality protection and restoration.
Great. Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair.
I've been mulling this over, and I found the discussion of the industrial permits to be very interesting and almost a sort of what do you call it when they run something on a movie that makes you want to go see it? It just made me want to learn more about it. And so I was going to suggest, Bruce, that at some point when we have time and room on the agenda, maybe we could get an overview of the permits, the industrial stormwater permit, but also whatever other permitting umbrellas that they work under, and set our priorities.
This spring, that might be timely because the statewide industrial permit actually has not been reissued for many years, and they've been working back and forth. And so there was a proposal to include some numeric limits in that permit, which a lot of pushback, and so there's going to be another round of public comment on the industrial stormwater permit, but State Board still is pushing to have that adopted this spring. So we'll try to see if we can cue all that up as to what the permit requires and how we implement it. It is a challenge because it's a statewide permit that parties file for coverage to Sacramento, but we at the regions then are expected to provide the oversight.
But I agree with that idea, and spring seems like the right timetable. What I'd really like to make sure is that we spend some time and solicit opinions from outside the organization. as to how we should set priorities. Clearly, we're not going to have enough resources to focus on 1,800 facilities for inspection. So I would like to know that we are seeking as broadly advice we can as to what subset of that deserves prioritization. And I think that that'll work, that idea.
Chairman, can I say a few words?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Well, I would like to make some comments over here about the budget. I'm so glad that finally our office is hiring some help. This has been permitted after a long drought. And secondly, I'm also glad that they hire some students from local universities to help them on a part-time basis or temporary basis. That capability they have, and that helps our agency. I always thought that rather than cutting back the programs, they should cut back the waste. You know, I wrote a letter to Governor, emailed him, and I pointed out that how many places misuse of money is in every program, although the redevelopment agency has been eliminated from all over, that how much saving will bring. But still I'm happy, and I don't want to outline where I have seen waste or misuse of funds. And that can eliminate some of the programs. I'm always against cutting the funds for schools. But let me say something here about one more thing. City of San Jose, starting January 1st, eliminated the use of plastics in the shops. And believe me or not, we are not used to carrying a bag. And to my surprise, when I go to the grocery store or someplace, they said, hey, you have a bag. Buy it for $1, $1.50 a bag, or pay 10 cents for a paper bag. If you need two bags, then you have to pay 20 cents paper bag and carry it. So slowly, we are getting used to it. I'm carrying bags in my car. I always carry a couple of bags whenever I'm there, so I go and buy something. So there is a transitional period for us, but the city of San Jose has enforced now, it is now started January 1st, no plastic bags in the stores. So this is one news you'd like to hear. Thank you.
Save those dimes, you could buy coffee.
Okay. Yeah.
Listen, this is a new format, or is it just me? The chair's report here?
We have put a new format following some of the updated
nice.
Logos from,
we're looking,
from Cal EPA.
We're looking modern here, finally.
It's a new year. So, yeah.
Thank you. Diane, you look like you're taking credit for some of this.
Yeah, so. No, she put it.
Well, no, it's time we get on with the world of corporate thinking
and
here.
And help our Angela.
Yes.
And the admin.
Well, congratulations.
The
I think
report,
it's...
So.
And as we baby boomers get older, we can actually read the print a little better, too, here. So it's getting a little bigger. Okay, I think that concludes, and I hate to ask the question. As long as maybe we can answer it quickly. If a judgment is ruled on a fine, legal staff, and it goes to the state revolving fund, does that go into the general fund, or does that stay in the state revolving fund that could be used back as loans? And just a quick answer. I'm not saying that personal experience at this, but it's getting very close to personal experience.
Are you talking about administrative civil liabilities? Or
I'm talking about a judge's ruling.
Oh, a judge's ruling. A superior court. It depends on which judge, what court, superior
that
court,
was a crazy
court of appeal.
Judge, but anyway, wasn't my most favorite judge. Go. It's not me personal, but it's something.
So it depends on the court.
Yeah, so if the court says XYZ, you owe $1 million, and we're going to send it to the state revolving fund. And that just – does that go to the general fund, or does that stay in the state revolving fund?
I think it depends on the statute on which the judge ruled on. So, I would need to have more facts to answer.
Typically,
sorry.
When we and – actually, this is part of what you'll hear on the information item later today, but the penalties from administrative civil liabilities most commonly go into the state board's cleanup and abatement account.
Okay.
Now, that is a separate account. Certainly the legislature always looks at any pots of money, and so State Board recognizes that it needs to be active in using that account for what it's designed to do, use statewide for cleanup and abatement situations. There's also sometimes penalty monies go into the waste discharge permit fund, and that offsets some of the fees that are levied against all of the waste dischargers. The state revolving fund, though, is a third
three-legged stool.
And that is largely funded through federal contributions to that, and then that becomes a loan and grant source. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there may be opportunities for a court to assign more funding to that with the idea that then it goes into the loan program and gets returned to use that way. But those are separate from the general fund.
Right.
And one thing I didn't mention in my report is that there has been further reduction in the State Water Board's reliance on general funds with some switch of activities such as basin planning activities from the general fund into those fees. And that's not necessarily met with total pleasure by all of the fee payers, but it on the flip side means that we're at the point of less than 10% of our funding is coming from general funds, which is part of the reason we don't face cuts.
Good. Thank you. It kind of understand a little bit clearer again, but let's hope we don't have to go there. So at this time we'll do swearing in. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hand, please. Do you promise to tell the truth?
So do.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to item six. Let me get organized.
Yes, item six is consideration of uncontested items. There are three items listed there. Actually, only two of those are action items, City of Pacifica and Hewlett-Packard and Stanford University. The third is status report on our cleanup programs, which we make to you every 6 months. There are no supplementals, and I'm not aware of any cards or.
No, I didn't know if City of Pacifica is represented here today. I didn't know if they wanted to make a brief comment after or not, but we could move forward. They're
so
comfortable, no comments.
I recommend adoption of the uncontested calendar.
Board member?
I do have a comment and a question. When I look at NPDES permits, I look at two things after I look at the kind of comments and responses. I look at the performance of the system and the flow. My experience giving wastewater grants was it's really crystal clear in a sewage treatment plant which ones are well run and which ones aren't. And it shows up in their flow requirements. I also look at flow because the winter peaks are pretty good evidence of the health of the system, and you can, in watching those, anticipate potential problems that lead to overflows. So I kind of do that on every single permit that comes through. And it was interesting on Pacifica because the BOD, the performance of the secondary treatment, is excellent. You know, you got a instantaneous highest daily discharge of 13 milligrams per liter with a standard of 30 as an average. That's a well-run sewage treatment plant. but there's a suspended sediment level of 69 with a standard of 30, and that's something's happening. There's been some upsets here and some rather mild ammonia violations. With a system like that, that's not of particularly unusual. So my question to Bruce and the staff was, there have been, and it's mentioned at least briefly, a couple periods of upset in the sewage treatment plant. And the biological systems, things go wrong. My concern is what the underlying root causes were, whether or not we've got a handle on it. Certainly over the course of the year, it's not a screaming concern with the highest BOD, but that anomalous suspended sediment level kind of sticks out. So I kind of would like to have a little answer for that on the record.
Lila, do you want to make a comment? Or I can make a comment.
My name is Lila Tang. I'm with the NPDES division at the Water Board, and I did take the oath. The city of Pacifica has had some problems. In 2008, they had a rather large upset, and we've finally completed the enforcement action for that. I'm not as familiar with the 2010 suspended solids or turbidity violations that occurred during that time. It is in the wet weather, so I suspect that there was a high flow during that period, and perhaps that decreased the efficiency of the plant. Part of our enforcement action that we initiated in 2008 was a cease and desist order, mainly on their collection system. They do have extremely high wet weather influent flows. And I think over time, when they're complying with the cease and desist order, that should alleviate that problem and they can run the plant a little bit better. You know, it is quite difficult to operate a plant that normally runs at a few million gallons per day, and then when it rains, and they're on the coast side, you know how hard the rains can be, to then ramp up all their systems to handle that flow. For the ammonia, that's something that they've been dealing with over the years. This is one of our newest treatment plants in the region, and they use something very innovative technology. Like, this is an aerobic digester as opposed to mostly the anaerobic ones. And so typically, if you notice, it's usually in the summertime when they have the ammonia problems, and that comes from the centrate from the solids handling facility from this aerobic system. And they have, I believe in 2010, they may have finally tweaked out the system so that it's running pretty well. They increase their ammonium sulfate feed so that the solids flocculate better, and so there's not so much carryover of ammonia containing matter back into the system and discharged, so it stays with the solids. So I mean, I'm pretty confident that they've got a good handle on it going forward.
So the overall performance is good. The plant upsets, to the best degree that we're aware, are winter flows, and of course, when the food for the system is really dilute and there's a lot of water running through it, it makes it very difficult. There is a program in place to reduce that and to do work on the...
Right, and in the summertime, I think they're dealing with that, the ammonia issue in the summertime.
Yeah. Well, the ammonia issue is, that's not a terrible concern. So just keep an eye on the suspended sediments. I appreciate the response. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Moore?
Yeah. Thanks to Board Member McGrath and Lila Tang for this discussion. I have a lot of interest in this case. I used to be the case handler when I was a Water Board staff for Pacifica. And then when I worked at Montgomery Watson as a consulting engineer, the person next to me in the next cubicle did the design of the new Pacifica treatment plant. And there, it does take a little bit more of a hands-on. It is an innovative technology. Excellent performance when it's working well. But this is a very good discussion. I want to take a step back. The one thing that kind of got my attention about the item was the number one comment from the city requesting, just on a numeric basis, to not have an ammonia effluent limit. you know, I can't imagine a scenario with a shallow water discharge where we wouldn't have a point of accountability that was enforceable for a nitrogen component to wastewater. It's just nitrogen and carbon are what these treatment plants are designed to manage, you know. So to me, it was not a very sane comment from the city. And then to have, you know, and then to have a very substantial management component related to the innovative aerobic digester that, if mismanaged, does not would pose some issue with ammonia. You know, it just, to me, it's not a credible comment. I thought staff responded very professionally to it. So that's it for Pacifica.
Thank you.
I'd like to make one point or one comment of support for item 6B while I have the microphone. I really like the Hewlett-Packard and Stanford project. I want to just express support for the experimental nature of it, of injecting compounds into the water. You know, 20 years ago, that was off limits. But I think this is a well-thought-out program. It's got a five-year, you know, review period that we can look at, keep an eye on the system. So I just wanted to express support for that innovative approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion on this item and staff's recommendation? Continue on.
Recommend adoption.
Yeah. And that was on the uncontested calendar.
Yes. I would move adoption of the uncontested calendar.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. Do you want to make a comment on behalf of the City of Pacifica? Since we
just wanted to clarify.
Come to the mic if you want to make a comment, please.
Hi, my name is Andy Eggleston. I'm stepping in for Monica Oakley today, who's been working with the City of Pacifica on this permit renewal. But it's my understanding that actually our comment about ammonia was just a tweak to the method for determining the limit and not actually to not have a limit at all. So I just wanted to clarify that. So thank you very much.
Thank you for the clarification. That's not how I read it.
We'll still abuse you, don't worry. But we might move forward in approving this staff recommendation. So we've had a motion and a second. And roll call vote, please, Mary.
Aye.
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 Aye. So ordered, and thank you. And I know there's been a lot of energy and effort put into this Pacifica plant down there, and hopefully you'll get it, as Lila said, getting it all dialed in after many years of new technology. So moving on to
Items 7, 8, and 9 are actually somewhat connected. The East Bay Discharges Authority, Dublin-San Ramon Services District, and City of Livermore actually comprise probably the largest and most significant infrastructure project in the Bay Area that nobody really knows about, because basically it was this board that drove essentially 9 wastewater treatment plants, 10 if you include the Castlewood plant, to consolidate both their treatment and their wastewater discharge through one discharge into central San Francisco Bay back in the 70s and 80s. And so this is reissuance of the permit for the East Bay Dischargers Authority and separate permits for Dublin-San Ramon Services District and City of Livermore. We do need to consider 3 different permits here, but because they're all interconnected, like Robert Schlipp to make staff presentation specific to all 3 permits.
Welcome. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Mueller and members of the board. My name is Robert Schliff. I'm an engineer in the MPDS Wastewater Control Division. The tentative orders in items 7, 8, and 9 would reissue the MPDS permits for the East Bay Dischargers Authority, or EBDA, the Dublin-San Ramon Services District, and the City of Livermore. And this presentation covers all three items because all three share the same record due to their unique relationship, which I'll briefly explain in the next slide. So the three permits before you are for EBDA, Dublin, San Ramon, and Livermore. And these permits cover six wastewater treatment plants, each providing secondary level treatment, which is the national standard for municipal wastewater treatment. And these four treatment plants, first Union Sanitary District or the Alvarado Treatment Facility, the Hayward Treatment Facility, Oraloma Castro Valley Plant, and the City of San Leandro's Treatment Plant, all discharge through the EBDA Deepwater Outfall, which is located about 7 miles offshore. And they're covered under a single permit we're calling the EBDA permit. And EBDA operates the outfall while each individual city or district operates its own plant. Therefore, they're all named in one permit. And although Dublin, San Ramon, and the City of Livermore, which are located way over here on the right side of the slide, all discharge through the same EBDA Deepwater Outfall, their effluent gets to the outfall through the Livermore Amador Valley Water Management Agency, our LAVMA pipeline, which is shown here, this dark line. And they each have individual permits. And this is because they are not members of EBDA and discharge under an agreement with LAVMA, who is in turn under an agreement with EBDA. And collectively, these six treatment plants serve most of Alameda County, from San Leandro south to Fremont and east to Livermore. So the four EBDA agencies, Dublin, San Ramon, and Livermore, in total serve about 900,000 people, and they operate about 2,500 miles of sewer pipe. And in 2011, the combined treated wastewater discharge was about 64 million gallons per day. The six treatment plants can provide treatment up to 107 million gallons per day in dry weather and 189 million gallons per day in wet weather. So now that I've covered some background information, I want to switch gears and just focus on the EBDA item. And this is because the permits for Livermore and Dublin San Ramon are uncontested. And we received comment letters on the EBDA item from EBDA, USEPA, and Baykeeper. And USEPA and Baykeeper are supportive of the tentative order. The main objection to this item is from EBDA, and this would just impact the EBDA permit. So EBDA's objection is about our proposal that each of its four member treatment plants be held individually to secondary treatment standards. In other words, the tentative order proposes to determine compliance for technology-based limits, where these four blue circles are shown in this schematic. And this differs from the current permit, where compliance with technology-based limits are allowed to be determined at the EBDA common outfall, or where this red circle is shown. And as with the current permit, EBDA believes that all four treatment plants constitute one treatment facility, and therefore compliance should continue to be determined after wastewater from these four facilities has mixed together. So our main contention with EBDA is over what constitutes a publicly owned treatment works, or POTW. And as I mentioned in the previous slide, EBDA contends that the entire system of four treatment plants and the EBDA common outfall constitutes one treatment system. And we do not agree. The Clean Water Act states that distinct treatment works owned by separate municipalities would each constitute a separate POTW. And under the Clean Water Act, each POTW must meet secondary treatment standards. And in this case, each of the four treatment plants are separately owned and operated. Also, the treatment standards mandate a certain level and type of treatment, primarily removal of solids and compounds that take up oxygen. And this type of treatment only occurs at each of the four treatment plants, not the EBDA common outfall. So if we continue to determine compliance at the common outfall, as EBDA proposes, this would allow for dilution from well-run plants to offset higher pollutant loads from poorly run plants. And this is clearly not the intent of technology-based limits that are the minimum level that's required for all treatment facilities. And finally, I want to point out that USEPA supports our position that each facility must comply with technology-based limits. And that concludes my presentation. What you're seeing here is the pump station at Oraloma, which is one of the prettier pump stations in the Bay Area. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Board member McGrath.
I did look at performance kind of to to drill down on this question. And the performance, I can't see readily and recall a distinction between the performance of the four, I believe it is, sewage treatment plants within EBDA. The table on page F11 shows a COD and a CBOD and a TSS performance. And I believe that's at the discharge point, which is
right, that's correct. Yeah,
which is excellent.
Yeah,
but it doesn't distinguish among those. And I did kind of teasing apart the two coming from the Livermore Valley. The Livermore plant is operated in a much higher level of removal,
mm-hmm.
And there are some high levels. So there's enough here to say, even though the overall performance is excellent, some of the sewage treatment plants are better. Can you walk me through what the difference in the performance of the member sewage treatment plants actually is?
Yeah, Mike's going to do that in his presentation.
Okay.
To give you like a quick thing, like the TSS, you know, it averages probably around 15 out of Hayward, around 10 out of Oraloma, around 10 out of San Leandro, and around 15 out of Union Sanitary District.
So the performance on all the plants is really
They're below 30. Yeah.
Any more staff questions? Yes, board member Moore.
Yeah, before we get the technical, I'll have technical comments later. But I had a question just in terms of policy. I worked on the North Bayside System Unit permit also, you know, 2 decades ago. That's a similar kind of system. How is our compliance determined in North Bayside System? Either Robert or Lila.
I'm sorry.
Or a quiz. Is the compliance point scenario that's proposed here for EBDA, is it similar at the North Bayside System Unit joint outfall?
This is Lila Tang. It's similar to what we're proposing. It's never been compliance at the combined outfall because those are very individual dischargers, and actually historically they've preferred not to be under the same permit.
Okay. Thank you.
And also we have a similar situation for the West County Agency. They share an outfall. The City of Richmond and a West County Wastewater District. In that permit, it's currently specified that they comply at each treatment plant, each of the two separate treatment plants.
Good. I think that's helpful. Thank you.
And Vice Chair, and then I'll get to you, Dr. Singh.
Yes, I had a question that I hope is not a curveball for anybody, but I was looking at the request to change monitoring frequencies at the upstream plants, and I noticed that buried in the responses to comments way back on page 6, there was a discussion that indicated that it takes 8 years of data to serve as evidence for someone to request a change in the monitoring frequency. Can you tell us whether that's 8 years is based on a statistical analysis or an EPA requirement or best professional judgment or something else I haven't thought of?
It's a best professional judgment. It's something that we worked out with a number of dischargers who were in the pretreatment program because, you know, after it's treated, after it's all combined with other flows, I think maybe a shorter period is okay. I mean, you don't see as much variability, but an influent, you will expect higher variability, and that was just kind of the time frame that we arrived at. You know, sitting around a table, there wasn't a statistical analysis. I think there's way too much variability in the data from all these many different treatment plants, and so it was arrived at out of the air.
Okay, so if we changed our best professional judgment, we could change the number.
Yes, we can.
But we don't want to. Yeah. I understand
that.
Well,
we sort of don't want to. We just updated the attachment H just last year.
Okay. And then I had a question for legal staff. It seemed to me that in large part the discussion about whether or not the secondary treatment standards had to be met at the effluent of each individual plant turned on a legal question. And I just wanted to clarify that it is your judgment that those are individual plants under the Clean Water Act and that they do need to have the secondary treatment technology standards met at the effluent to each plant.
Yes, it is my judgment. It is the State Water Board's judgment. It is the US EPA's judgment that each of the POTWs have to meet the technology-based limits at the treatment plant as opposed to the common outfall.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Just a point of clarification, the comment by East Bay Discharges Authority had only to do with industrial pretreatment. So, and that's one of the reasons, having been responsible for an industrial pretreatment program at the Oakland Airport industrial area, industrial clients come and go, and so their flow comes and goes, and you need to have some level of. But I wanted to make clear that the comment had to do with industrial, and because there's no.
Yes, I switched gears in the middle there because there are different parts of the discussion over the permit that had to do with influent and effluent monitoring at each plant, and also then for priority pollutants as opposed to conventional pollutants. So I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. I was talking about priority pollutants in one sentence and conventional pollutants in the other.
Because my head started spinning. I'm trying to follow.
Board Member Singh, are you completed? Yeah.
I have a question, but I know that according to Clean Water Act, we should have a compliance at every plant, and I agree with what you have done. But I was wondering that we are still going to monitor the one common point plant and see that how they mix up and what happens on the way when it goes through the transportation. Do the changes take place? I was kind of curious about it. And also I was wondering that if there was a violation of compliance at one point in the past, how did you determine where the violation occurred if they're only reporting at one point? I mean, how did you monitor it in the past? Or what methodology did you use?
Yeah, well, in the past, they have been monitoring from all facilities. It's just compliance was determined at the common outfall. So we have treatment plant data for total suspended solids and biochemical oxygen demand, which are the two technology-based limits from all treatment facilities.
So they can't blame each other all the time.
No, they can't.
Maybe we'll let Mike come forward and make some comments and shed a little light on this discussion.
Thank you, Chairman Mueller. I'm Mike Connor, General Manager of EBDA. I have my expert technician helping me get my slides up here.
And to point, you were pointing with us.
All right. Could you reintroduce yourself, Mike, please?
I'm Mike Connor. I'm general manager at the East Bay Discharges. Mm-hmm. I swore the oath. Thank you very much for hearing our permit. And Robert gave a little piece on how the permit worked. And my background is I've only been general manager at EBDA for 3 years, so I don't know fully the history on all the pieces and how decisions were made. This is EBDA's sixth permit, and so all the permits have come through the board, and that's the decisions that have been made for six permit cycles, and this issue that's under debate has actually been debated for several other permit cycles too. So we've come to different conclusions previously. I don't understand why we've come to different conclusions previously, but I think it'd be useful at this time to talk about, to use the permit every, given my background of, you know, a third of my career at EPA, a third of my career working for nonprofits, and the rest of the time working for public agencies that discharge into the bay, I've really been hit time and time again, and it was sort of preached to us at EPA in Boston, that it's a partnership between the state regulatory agency and the regional wastewater discharges. We're public agencies, publicly elected boards, and so we, it's sort of like your partnership with EPA. They're sort of telling you nationally what to do, and in theory, you're always working together, though you have some differences maybe now and again. Similarly, as you come up with regional plans, we're the folks who are out there in the public meetings, trying to figure out how to make them go. This stack of papers, to produce this stack of papers, by a wastewater agency is probably a 5 to 7 year process once we decide to go ahead between bidding it out, going through CEQA, ESA, all these things. So little simple decisions that we're trying to make. You're working, trying to explain to us where to go so that we can then figure out how to get the rest of the public to go and make things work. And so the earlier comments about Chairman Mueller, your work in relating the agricultural community needs, in many ways, that's what our agencies are also trying to do. So I think at a permit, it's a chance to, every 5 years, reevaluate where we've come from, how we're doing, and what our future is, and what our work that we want to accomplish in the future. So Robert went through this, and I'd have to say, Robert, one thing that we worked in a partnership with is I asked Bruce, I would like Robert to be our permit writer. He has the reputation of being the best permit writer in California, I think is what we say. And so I've been very pleased in working with Robert on this permit. He's been excellent. And as he mentioned, there are several agencies that tie in. And essentially, EBDA was formed, as Bruce said in his earlier comments, EBDA was formed to meet a requirement from you guys that you didn't want to have local discharges into shallow water from each of these facilities. And so with the help of Senator Feinstein, Larry Walker from your agency wearing that hat, EBDA was formed to sort of move the small agencies together to form a joint public agency to build the pipe and to have a deep water discharge. In addition, most of the funding for all the construction when you upgraded the treatment plant simultaneously, a good portion of that funding went through EBDA. So EBDA was also sort of the agency that was formed to try to get things moving. And I think we can see over time that it's been quite successful. Back in the 60s and 70s, this is TSS, 30 parts per million is the limit. Back in the 60s and 70s, this number was probably up in here in the 60-fold range and kept improving with the construction of secondary. You can see we're right around 30-ish in early January and have come down to we're now between 10 and 15 from the various agencies. And you can see this is EBDA, Hayward, City of San Leandro, Oraloma, and Union Sanitary District. You can see there's quite a bit of variation, and some agencies have good times, and some agencies have months that they're less good compared to the other agencies. And one thing about being EBDA, and in the audience you are the artist of all those nice whales, Darren Greenwood from Livermore, and also folks from USD and Dublin San Ramon. You can see that we meet monthly, and in some ways there's become an informal competition amongst agencies to see who can have the best performance. And we work together to solve joint problems and to try to figure out how we can make things go. Jim mentioned the question, well, how do we do compared to other areas around the Bay Area? And I don't know. This graphic came from Chuck Weir, my predecessor, for a presentation he was doing for the city of San Leandro. But you can see there's Dublin San Ramon, there's Hayward, there's Livermore, Oraloma, San Leandro, and Union Sanitary District. You can see, in general, we're all running in the 10 to, well, less than 10, 6 to 12, 14 range. And considering that the CBOD limit's 25, doing pretty good. And in general, essentially running like the median of the Bay areas, there's some plants that are lower. You're getting a little more removal from, say, San Jose and stuff, which have more advanced treatment built. So I think what these graphics show is over the last 5 years, we've had quite a bit of accomplishment together in our partnership to make things work. And you can see this issue was really debated again at the previous permit around right about here. And you can see in the last 5 years, with improvements at each of the plant that the performance, in fact, is still improving plant by plant. And we're there. A lot of that's little operational tricks to do a better job of cleaning the effluent. Now, the two major toxics issues that the regional board has tried to get its partners to work on and improve has been the copper site-specific standard in South Bay. And you can see over time our copper discharge from January 2002 has come down, by a factor of 40% perhaps. Our limit is 53. We're down now to around 10, 7, 8. And then the other big piece has been mercury. And you see mercury from January. This is in loadings of kilograms per year. The EBDA goal in the year 2018 is to be at 2.2 kilograms per year. You can see we're under that by about a factor of 2. And so, in general, the facilities are been very successful in moving forward and doing a good job at handling what we understand to be the top priorities of our partners at the regional board. So we look forward to working with our partners at the regional board in the future and continuing to solve the issues that face the Bay. And as my board likes to say, we're willing to spend every penny necessary to have a clean San Francisco Bay and not one penny more. So it's really important that we figure out exactly what we need and what's going to make a difference. Thank you very much.
I have some question here.
Yep, Dr. Singh.
The data you presented, man, I really appreciate that you are accomplishing everything, mercury, lead, and total sediment concentration, all of them are going down. We can see the chart. What I'm asking you, that in the past, annual report you submit, there was one, is it right? For all six water treatment plants, did you submit one report?
Yes.
Now, what is the requirement? I would like to ask your staff. Now they have to submit six reports, is it right?
So conceptually, they would submit three reports. One report for EBDA, which includes the four treatment plants along the bay, and then Livermore and Dublin San Ramon each submit their own reports because they have separate permits. However, the data, like a lot of the mercury data and copper data, they share that data because we're determining compliance for those limits where they discharge to the bay. So that's why these three permits are always together. There's some, you know, commonality to them. But the issue here is the technology. We would like for each treatment plant that's separately owned and operated to each comply with TSS and BOD limits because we think that's the intent of the technology-based standards.
What I want to ask you that, you know, this is why I've been talking in the past that, of course, we are tightening up the regulations and we are requiring more and more accountability. At the same time, to reduce the cost of producing these annual reports, you know, I always say that we should streamline the process and make, probably already have some template. They can provide them that they can put the data. So help the agency. It is not always necessarily the cost has to go up drastically. From one report, now they will be submitting three reports, and this is quite a laborious job. So we should keep on working. My recommendation to the staff, to improve the reporting system,
right? There's
efficiency of that.
There's really no change in the reporting requirements. There's the number of reports remain the same. It's this is more a legal issue of where the compliance should be for BOD and TSS. We haven't changed who's permitted, who's not permitted, or you know any of the reporting requirements really.
Board Member McGrath.
You know, I go back on this to when my good friend Peter Perez was working on the consolidation of the agencies with the regional board, and there was controversy over the size of the pipeline. That's, what, 35, 36 years. And I look at the treatment plant performance that you showed us for all the sewage treatment plants, and I just look at that as a phenomenal success for the program. we can, and I'm excited that you're competing to be the best of the best, but I look at that performance and the battle over secondary treatment plant standards that we went through in the 70s with the passage of the Clean Water Act, and I just, you know, so I'm looking at six sewage treatment plants, five of which perform at, by my standards, an excellent, and the other one, not so bad, but not so good. And I'm confused, Mike. I mean, Mike Connor is one of the people that I try to meet with a couple times a year because he's way smarter than me, and I learn a lot of stuff, and he thinks differently enough that there are things that I'd never think about on my own. And I just, I'm confused as to why. I mean, it seems to be why your concern is. It seems to be a moot point. The sewage treatment plants are operating in an excellent manner. It looks, from what I've read in the order, that they're on top of anticipating the need for increased capacity. I mean, maybe you just wanted to get up here and show you how good a job your members are doing, which... But is
well,
there really
I guess there would be two issues, and one reason to lead you through. What's broken that we need to fix?
Yeah, that's what is broken.
It's working. The existing permit structure is working extraordinarily well. We have, instead of limits at each of the facilities, we measured each of the facilities, and we have language.
But I don't.
We have wait a minute, Jim. We have language in our permit that says each of the facilities must provide secondary treatment. That's working pretty good. We've had a big if this is wrong, why didn't we fix this 30 years ago?
But, Mike, I completely agree with you. It's working extremely well. It's something that I think you and your members can be very proud of. And it's not broken in one sense, but I don't see this breaking it either. What I'm missing something. What is this adding as a problem? That's what my question is.
And I guess for the agencies, it's not clear. In some ways, this is the devil we know. We're moving to the devil we don't know. And so to some extent, there's a question of how is this going to be implemented? How will this change as we implement it? How will this change things? So you could say, well, if you had that other point, what might you do differently in treatment that would make a difference. As we go into energy recovery and nutrient removal, there may be some things you'd do differently as different plants if you were just trying to meet the goal at the outfall rather than... And so the big discussion of energy savings in Europe is the way those permits are written, they have a lot more variability to be able to deal with how much aeration they do or how much recycling they do that allows them a little flexibility. But again, my agencies are concerned about this. I'm representing them. And they're essentially, they know it's working now. They're a little worried about how it's going to work in the future. That's the nature of the demand.
It just seems like this is a little bit of a moot point.
Yeah, and I just like to put it into historical context because I wrote the first permit in 1979 for EBDA, and at that time, not all the plants, because the project wasn't complete, were able to meet the secondary standards. So we put into that permit individual interim limits above the 30-30 requirement specific to each plant. Then when the project was complete, at the next reissuance, we took out the interim limits but forgot to put in specifically the 30-30 for each plant. So the intent was always to regulate the discharge at each facility because the overall effort was to bring each of the facilities up to secondary. In fact, that need to bring them up to secondary provided the opportunity to get the state and federal funding, which... by and large, constructed the project.
So now we can blame it on you instead of EBDA, right?
That, yeah.
So, Vice Chair?
He's already stepped up to the plate to take the blame, as I understand it. Yes, I have a couple of questions, but I want to frame them just a little bit. With respect to the conventional pollutants and the technology-based standards, I don't sense that this board has any choice but follow the advice of his legal counsel on that one. So the issue about conventional pollutants seems pretty clear to me in terms of my role as a board member. But then we look at priority pollutants, and that's a long list. And I should have asked staff this question, but I'm sure you can answer it. I just wanted to make sure that I'm reading this correctly and that the our requirements and our enforcement point for the priority pollutants is at the EBDA outfall.
Yes.
001.
Yes.
Okay. And not at the effluent to the individual plants. So then I wanted to move to the proposal in your letter to change the frequency of monitoring of the priority pollutants, both in the influent and in the effluent to the upstream plants, which is, as I understand it, primarily a way to keep a handle on the pretreatment programs and also to keep a handle on what's going on, you know, what's coming in and out. So in making the in proposing to change the frequency, I think it was from twice per year, influent and effluent, in the upstream plants to once per year. Do you have a sense of whether that's real money that's going to be saved?
This raises a bigger issue, and Jim and you spoke about it a little in your introductory remarks. Are we doing the right thing? Are we too busy to do the right thing because we're doing other stuff? And that's really where this falls. To what extent do we focus on priority pollutants, which were a huge issue in the 80s? And it also gets to the Baykeeper comments. Interestingly, Baykeeper didn't really care about TSS and BOD, and neither does the Bay, I think. But at this point, the emerging contaminants are probably much more of an issue. So we submit, you know, as I say, I submit 800 pages of DMRs every year, of which 700 pages have below detection limits. So
DMRs?
Discharge monitoring reports.
Thank you.
So that's our permit required report. So ultimately, the question is a bigger question. You know, where do we really want to be spending our energy on monitoring and focusing? And I think in some ways Robert's response was a good response that it said, we're still trying to figure this out with the regional monitoring program, and that's until we figured it out and we're spending a lot of energy, we'll probably want to keep on doing what we're doing. The money involved's not huge, but the time and expertise, I mean, for all these things, when you put energy in certain ways, you don't put it in other ways. And similarly, your comments about meeting with Coleman, in some ways, we don't do a good job of getting together as the wastewater agencies, which are all public agencies, and trying to figure out where are we trying to go in the future and what make. And I'm not sure we can articulate for ourselves real coherently where we're trying to go in the future, but I think that would really be a useful thing to start to think about. And we're doing a little bit of that with the board on item by item, but not how do we be more sustainable so in 25 years our residents thank us for thinking ahead so far.
Medium money, lots of effort. That's your answer?
it's the focus. And again,
okay.
It's where people are focusing.
All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Board Member Moore has another appointment, so we're any further comments or questions? Yeah, Board Member McGrath.
I just like to follow up on that. I think Dr. O'Connor is correct. I mean, he was one of the first people that pointed out to me that it's the problems of the future more than the conventional problems that we should be thinking about. And I am sympathetic to the argument that 800 pages of reports largely on things that don't matter is something that we should care about. And I think we do. And I think that will change over time. I think it will take a period of time to figure out how we should be monitoring more accurately. And in those respects, I do appreciate your comments. I think you are trying to get us focused on the right things. I don't think it's time yet to do that, but I think we've heard your comments.
Any other board member more?
Yeah, I appreciate the thoughtfulness of this discussion, and I think I would point out, and thanks for the report on the effluent quality. That's very pertinent. I come to this with great interest, you know, but I think one thing I'm hearing from the EBDA consortium is sort of having it both ways. And I would submit, really, as a regional board member, I see a trade-off between the priority pollutant type monitoring and having more accountability on TSS and BOD. I performed a treatment plant model in 1998 of the San Francisco Southeast treatment plant and doing fate and transport of priority pollutants, mostly organics. I'm very familiar with, you know, how physical properties of aqueous solubility, vapor pressure, and partitioning coefficients between solids and water affect the fate of dioxins, PCBs, you know, all of these different pollutants, congener by congener, through a treatment plant. And guess what? TSS and BOD removal are the things that help us keep priority pollutants out of the receiving waters. So having accountable TSS and BOD limits at the treatment plants is a trade-off for me for a lot of priority pollutant monitoring. I think you know, in general, the folks in the audience would agree that a well-run treatment plant is going to do a good job of removing a lot of pollutants in addition to a good source control program. So I come from that perspective. I agree with Dr. Connor about, you know, these were issues in the 80s, and not all pollutants follow right with TSS and BOD, but most do. And there's actually a biochemical reason, you know, that relates to toxicity to human beings and aqueous solubility. It all makes sense. So I think, you know, I just want to say I support the staff recommendation. I commend the treatment plants for their improved performance. When I was basin plan chief, I was not impressed with the performance of the EBDA agencies, and I advocated for this type of a regulatory structure. I continue to advocate for it. I think the threat of this type of regulatory structure was part of the reason why the improvements were made at the treatment plants. I'm proud of the accomplishments of our partners, but I say let's move forward with the staff recommendation. Thanks.
Any further comments, or everyone comfortable?
You could probably let Mr. Connors, Dr. Connors.
No, I think what you should do is individually take us all out to lunch, or I guess we can't go out to lunch with them all. We'll pay for our own lunch.
Yes.
Yeah. And you and Jim have this great bantering back and forth about the past and the future, and I think that's what's remarkable about the comments.
Well, I served on his board at the Estuary Institute. I mean, yeah. He's a really bright guy.
Well, you're all very bright, too. And I think the comments are understood that we're all trying to do the right thing here to bring this to a signing of a permit for the next 5 years. And it looks like improvements are definitely being made. And as the vice chair said, you know, the time factor, and I think if we look at life, our most valuable part of life is time. You know, and how much more time do we have to do the right thing? There's always someone out there with money to pay for things, but do we have the time to do the things that need to be done? So I think staff has done a wonderful job along with the dischargers to try to bring this to the right conclusion here. And I feel that with staff's recommendation, we're on the right track. And it's going to be interesting in the next few years how much history is left around here and where we're all going with history. And so hopefully it's recorded and kept and some kind of a little disc and not a big 8-pound packet of paper. So, yes, Vice Chair. Yes.
I sense that we are moving towards resolution of these issues, and I did want to provide some comments. I think we have a number of issues in front of us. One set involves the conventional pollutants, and my colleagues have talked about those. And personally, I don't see that we, as a board, can do anything but take take the advice of our legal staff. And as I understand from my colleagues, there's good reason to do that. But I do want to get back to the priority pollutants, because half of what I had planned to say here is what Dr. Connor said, which is that we have we don't want to be spending a lot of energy looking at things that we know are not problems in the particular, you know, places where we're looking. So I did want to just mention as background for this discussion that I'm sure you all noticed that in the compliance summary for the treatment plants that are in item 7 and 8 and 9 is flawless. There were no violations of numeric effluent limitations during the course of the permit. I think that's important to remember here. The reasonable potential analysis, which is a sort of another window into what's being discharged from the plants, shows that there are very few compounds for which we got hits on the reasonable potential analysis. Third, the JEPA, the Joint Powers Agreement that holds EBDA together, from the description in the staff report, sounds to me like it was very well crafted, because if there is a violation at the joint outfall, EBDA has the power to go back to the four agencies, to go back upstream and solve the problem. There is not a lack of accountability nor enforcement authority within the system here. And that's important. The industrial pretreatment program is mature, according to EBDA's comments, and I take that at face value. So the monitoring of the influent and the effluent from the treatment plants for priority pollutants may be a small thing, but I do think it's a big thing in terms of our focus. And I think we should internalize that request. I do plan to vote for this permit. I don't want to hold it up. But I was also struck by the fact that EBDA wanted to decrease the frequency of monitoring for the priority pollutants in the influent and the effluent of the upstream plants, and what seemed open to taking those resources and that energy and starting to look at other things that might be coming down the pike, which is what Baykeeper was also requesting. So I'm going to throw out an idea, which would be that because we have reopener provisions in these permits that I understand, if we have some new information, such as perhaps the water recycling policy that comes out of the State Board, that we stay open to the idea of perhaps EBDA, our staff, with input from SFEI, perhaps Baykeeper, if they could come up with a plan that would be in the form of a sort of a special study that would say, look, we can take the resources from the priority pollutant monitoring upstream, put those resources into monitoring some perhaps emerging contaminants that will help us as a scientific community get a handle on what's going on with these pollutants in the bay, specifically not be a precedent for all of the other treatment plants, but be in the nature of creating additional information that helps us understand what's going on. I, as a board member, would be certainly willing to listen to a package that was brought back of ideas that are, I think, could have the potential for being win-win-win. So I feel like I'm on a soapbox, but I wanted to throw that out. I think it would be an interesting way to move forward and start to shift the focus. Let me state from the benefit of my fellow board members that, and because I keep forgetting this, the State Board is going to come up with a water recycling policy, we're told, soon, which is going to perhaps create some new monitoring requirements for new chemicals in the bay. And so it's appropriate, I think, not to make changes that then, at this point, before that state board policy comes out, that would be seen as precedents for other permits. Last thing, can I shift focus one more time? Because then
I just want to make sure I understand.
Yes, sir.
You're not suggesting that this be done at this time. You're more or less inviting a well thought out proposal.
I'm inviting some. Yes.
Okay.
Some thing to come later that would be innovative, intriguing, creative, further the science in the bay, and
I'd like to voice support. I'd like to voice support for that approach. Dr. Young, thanks.
Then I did want to touch on one other issue, and that was Baykeeper's comment about what are we going to do with the sediment, about rolling backwards information from sediment toxicity into our permits. And I understand the staff's response that I've forgotten exactly how they put it, but we have to deal with the triad now. We're dealing with toxicity, we're dealing with community changes, and we're also dealing with sediment chemistry. I just wanted to sort of throw out for staff's thinking in the future that if we should run into a situation where we have an area of sediment where we know that the chemistry shows us that there are the constituents that we think might be too high, and that this is backed up by changes in the community and in toxicity problems, that it would be relevant then to start looking at the potential for monitoring those, if we're not already monitoring those substances in some of the nearby effluents. So I just wanted to throw that out there again for the future, for us to be starting to think about what we're going to do in those circumstances. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I know this discussion is getting longer, but I would like to make some comments. First of all, the idea of exploring recycling is a great idea. I always for recycling, and there are a lot of advantages to recycling. You know, this proposal, although he said there's an old American saying, if an ant broke, don't fix it. I agree with that comment of Dr. Connor over there. But at the same time, there is a law, clean water law. It requires that a treatment plant should be compliance monitoring station. Now, I don't know how costly it will be to set up 6 different monitoring stations and what consequences. Maybe their staff can give you time. Also, you can apply for some grant, even to the water board. They have some fund over there so that you can meet that requirement. There will be ongoing cost rather than having one monitoring station. You need a staff and monitoring at each 6 sites. I know there are cost increase over here involved, but how much will be installation cost, the monitoring station, that maybe a staff can give you going with the budget available, how to handle that. But at the same time, I do agree that monitoring should be done at each treatment plant, and that's the State Clean Water Act. And we have to vote according to the Act. I'm sorry to say that, even though it ain't broke. So thank you. I'm going to support this one.
Thank you. And I think, as the Vice Chair mentioned about the future, and we're looking, again, just from a broad perspective from growth in California and that area, I mean, it really kind of is the world of growth out there. I mean, if you look at the industrial complex and the buildings that are continuing to be built, even though the housing world has changed for them, you know, you have 900,000 people. There's going to be 1 million people out there in the next 5-10 years, I would imagine. So, I mean, the growth is still going to come out there because you still have land, and people are going to want to do something unless open space gets a hold of it all in this. So, Yes.
I want to support with a minor clarification Dr. Young's comment. It certainly makes no sense to spend public money monitoring and continuing to monitor things that we have a good record are going to be non-detect. And we can, but we don't yet have a proposal, I think, approve something that trims that down substantially. I do want to make sure, because industrial sources are diverse, they come and go without our permits, that there is a replacement for influent that enables the entities to have a strong pretreatment program. So that has to be part of it. It can be much more efficient than it is now. I absolutely agree with that.
Yes, and I did want to clarify that the proposal that was on the table that we are not accepting at this point in time was to go from twice a year to once a year. So there would still be influent monitoring, and I agree with you. We do have to keep a handle on that.
Let's spend much money, less money, smarter.
I think my wife's quote, it doesn't cost, it pays. Right? Doesn't cost a pace. So we've given this a pretty fair shake here, I believe, for all parties involved. And I thank the board for their comments. As usual, you're amazing. Staff, if you're ever working on permits, you know what you have to look forward to from this board. So it's just a little sign of the...
Even for the best permit writer in California.
That's right.
In the United States, I would say.
And for that... same salary as 16 years ago. We're still after you. So at this time, staff, continue recommendation.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Before the recommendation.
And we're doing 7, 8, and 9 separate, right?
Yeah. Just one comment, clarification on Vice Chair Young's comment about the State Board water recycling policy. The policy actually was adopted, and as part of that, a study has been made on, and in fact, an expert panel has made recommendations on which constituents emerging concern should be monitored. State Department of Public Health made some additional recommendations, and that's still going through various machinations. So the State Board hasn't returned to say, okay, these are the constituents that really should be monitored. And so we're awaiting that, and I think we would all agree that that would be a trigger opportunity to say, okay, let's look at what we can do in terms of constituent emergent concern monitoring and priority pollutant monitoring that makes sense, and use that as a vehicle not only for the EBDA system but throughout the region. So we agree that this is something that is ripe to look at in the permit term. With that, I do recommend adoption of Item 7, the reissuance of the NPDES permit for the East Bay dischargers and associated agencies. The revised tentative order before you, we don't have any supplemental, and I don't recommend any changes.
I move the stack for recommendation for adoption.
I'll second that.
Moved and second for item 7. Roll call vote, please, Mary.
Aye.
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 Aye. Moving on to 8.
Item 8 is the reissuance of the permit for the Dublin-San Ramon Services District. And Robert's presentation covered this. I'm not aware if you have any cards or...
No.
So I would recommend... adoption of the revised tentative order before you.
Move for approval.
Move in a second, please.
My second.
Moved in second. Roll call vote. Mary, please.
Mr. Aliaga? Aye.
Mr.
Moran?
Aye.
Mr. Moore? Aye.
Dr. Singh? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So ordered.
This is called working.
And number 9?
And item 9 is reissuance of the NPDES permit for the city of Livermore, and I recommend adoption of the revised tentative order for that.
I move staff recommendation.
I second it.
And comments, please?
I would like to make one comment, and it's not a major one, but the city of Livermore did request that we put all of our monitoring and reporting requirements together in one table for clarity for people to be able to look at. And I understand from the staff response that each of the different component tables has a different function, and that is certainly a good comment, and it's understandable why we would not want to collapse them. I would, however, suggest that perhaps staff could think about in the staff report putting everything together, because I, for one, have a horrible time going back and forth and back and forth. Maybe the permittees know how to do this because they've done it for so long, but it takes me a long time to read these permits, figure out who's monitoring for what, where, and which the effluent points are. So if we could have one map, you know, one series of tables, and do it in the staff report, then it hopefully would not cause the confusion that you're afraid it's going to cause. And I just throw that out there as a thought or an idea for you to consider.
And I might warn you, you have two PhDs shaking your head, so you imagine if they can't figure out, how in the hell I figure it out, you know. So, comment quickly.
We just want to make sure that there's a disclaimer. We could try to summarize something like that, but have to have a disclaimer.
Yes.
It's the requirements in the order that are enforceable.
Understand where all the PhDs are like this? Okay, thank you. And we need a motion and a second? Or did we get one?
We got
all right,
that.
I apologize. Roll call vote, please. Yes, your comments, yes. Aye.
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 Aye. Thank you all. This is a pretty lengthy, a lot of hard work by everyone and a lot of energy and funds put in. So
thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve. Good luck. And then moving on to item 10, it's up to the boards where the quick break, or we'll let our patient presentation get going here. Want to knock it out? Okay, let's knock it out.
Yeah.
Okay, item 10 is information item on supplemental environmental projects for administrative civil liabilities, and this is something the board's had a long interest in, and we've been implementing these for 20 years, but there have been some changes, and I'd like Athena Honorary from the San Francisco Estuary Partnership to update us on the latest in supplemental environmental projects.
Thank you for your patience and welcome.
Of course. Well, good morning, Chair Mueller and members of the board. As Bruce stated, I'm Athena Honore with the San Francisco Estuary Partnership.
May I get you to speak a little louder, please?
Oh, of course. How's this? I'm Athena Honore with the San Francisco Estuary Partnership, and I provide oversight and assistance for supplemental environmental projects, or SEPs, for the Water Board. So I wanted to start off with a brief definition of what SEPs are. SEPs are an alternative to paying full fines imposed by an administrative civil liability or ACL order. Dischargers may satisfy up to half the fine by completing or funding an SEP. And SEPs are projects that enhance the beneficial uses of waters of the state, that provide a benefit to the public at large, and that are not otherwise required of the discharger. Pursuing an SEP is at the discretion of the discharger and cannot be imposed. So today I'll talk about the recent State Water Board policy on SEPs, changes in projects, and the Estuary Partnership's role in oversight and project selection. And then we'll look at some completed and current projects. At the end, I'll talk about how to get candidate projects considered for an SEP opportunity. The State Water Board policy on SEPs was adopted in February 2009, and it establishes some baseline requirements of SEPs. Most importantly, there must be a nexus or a relationship between the nature or location of the violation and the SEP. Educational projects are no longer supported, and the SEP may fulfill no more than 50% of the fine imposed by the ACL. Also, oversight is required for projects. SFEP typically fills the oversight role, ensuring that projects are completed per the project scopes, reviewing expenditures, and ensuring that all SEP dollars are spent. Dischargers must pay for the cost of oversight, and under the policy, that oversight cost is now over and above the cost of the project. Lastly, projects must establish and meet performance standards. We now have a very nice map showing SEPs that have been undertaken in Region 2 from the year 2000 to the present. The active projects are in red and completed projects in blue. You can see the geographic distribution of these past projects. Generally, an SEP is conducted near where the violation occurred or in the associated watershed. I encourage you to go to the partnership's website where you can find out more about these projects. SEPs have evolved considerably since this region started using them in the resolution of ACLs. The board has approved over 90 SEPs worth more than $8.3 million in projects. And we can use the SEP policy date as a dividing point. Projects completed before 2009 were pre-policy, then there was a short transition period, and current projects, which wrap up between 2014 and 2016, represent those adopted after the policy. SEPs are growing in value, and the value of the 10 current projects is roughly equal to the decade's worth of projects immediately before the policy was adopted. The median project value pre-policy was under $50,000, and the median for those settled after the policy approaches $300,000. Before the SEP policy, it was common to fund small educational projects, such as lab equipment or watershed curricula at local schools. Small projects as low as $3,000 account for the smaller median project value pre-policy. The current minimum amount for an SEP is $20,000. Looking at project type also shows us some changes in SEPs. There historically has been diversity in types of projects, and these recently completed projects cover a range of categories, such as education, marine mammal rehabilitation, habitat preservation or land acquisition, sewer lateral improvement, studies, restoration, conversion to LID, recycled water, and education. More recently, due to a high number of enforcement actions related to sewage spills, currently active projects concentrate strongly in the category of lateral improvement projects. These are typically offered by a municipality whose POTW has discharged sewage to the bay or ocean as a funding assistance program to private homeowners to inspect and repair leaking sewer laterals. These projects can repair hundreds of laterals. You can see restoration and LID are also represented here, though at a smaller dollar amount. The Estuary Partnership provides required oversight for adopted SEPs, reviewing required reports, working with dischargers and board staff to resolve any problems that arise in the implementation of projects. We also assist with required reporting to the state, tracking projects in CWICS or the California Integrated Water Quality System, and maintaining records for an annual audit by the State Water Board. We can also match candidate projects to SEP opportunities, providing selection assistance to dischargers. Some examples of recently completed SEPs include upgrades to the Marine Mammal Center, a facility that rehabilitates injured marine mammals from the bay and coast. The center's original buildings were modified freight shipping containers, and those had fallen into disrepair after 20 years of heavy use. Recent SEP funds covered the construction of new pens and pools and a shade structure for rehabilitation of elephant seals, sea lions, and other animals. The image at the top left is actually a sculpture at the entrance to the Marine Mammal Center. East Bay Mud completed an SEP recently to characterize stormwater in Cerrito Creek, as well as dry weather, first flush, and wet weather flows at Eddy Street Pump Station, and a limited pilot diversion of flows to Eddy Street from 2008 to 2010. The numerous constituents sampled included zinc, copper, mercury, PCBs, pesticides, TSS, caffeine, and more. The study quantified pollutant loading, removal rates, loading to biosolids, and impacts to air and treatment plant processes. SFPUC also recently completed an SEP at 5 San Francisco elementary schools to remove impervious surface and construct rain gardens, cisterns, and native and edible gardens, as well as providing a related educational curriculum. These schools are now diverting tens of thousands of gallons of water from the combined sewer system. industrial wastewater violation led to an SEP by C&H Sugar, which assisted in the acquisition of the 423-acre Franklin Canyon property, which includes riparian habitat for Rodeo and Refugio Creeks, now protected by the Muir Heritage Land Trust. The parcel adjoins the Fernandez Ranch acquisition, and together over 1,100 acres were protected from the threat of development. Lastly, an SEP helped fund a Rambaroo Island restoration work. Phase one was funded partly by an SEP from the ACL for the Sewage Agency of Southern Marin's big wastewater spill in January of 2008. The project has just completed transforming an eroded scarp at the island's edge to a regraded sand and gravel beach, which will provide haul-out areas and eventually bird habitat once plants are established. And let's turn to currently active projects. You noted the many lateral improvement projects underway now. This example is from the City of San Mateo's private sewer lateral repair program, and the images here show some of the outreach materials that the city has used to attract potential participants. The brochure at the top right and the open house shown here, and the image on the right is a lawn sign that residents who have had their sewer laterals repaired can post to increase visibility for the program. Other active programs are being conducted by the town of Hillsboro, SASM, Pacifica, and San Bruno. There are ongoing opportunities for new projects to be funded through SEPs. Several SEPs are approved in an average year. I keep a list of potential projects for future SEP opportunities, which is available here on the Water Board's enforcement webpage. And anyone can have their project added to that list by emailing me. SEPs must be reviewed and approved by the Water Board. Any projects that are selected for an SEP must meet several criteria. They must meet local priorities. They must include well-defined tasks, milestones, timelines, budgets, as well as performance standards. And project proponents must be responsive and timely in developing a full project narrative to be included in the settlement agreement for the ACL. We use a template shown here at the right to ensure that the project includes all the required elements under the SEP policy. To conclude, SEPs are a valuable funding source for local projects, and they can help dischargers complete beneficial projects in the community. Staff are continuing to explore SEPs in the resolution of some active ACLs, and information about SEP projects, current and completed, can always be found at the Estuary Partnership's webpage on SEPs. Are there any questions for me?
Thank you.
I have a question here. Yep. Tina, one thing I saw that about 30% of the project money, SIP money, has gone into studies. Now, who does all these studies? Because that's a big chunk. You showed, I estimated to be about 30%. And then, second question is, you said no education, the state board says. Mm-hmm. But also, there was allocation for educational purposes, a small allocation I saw. And third question is that I didn't see any mark on your picture in South Bay. You have any project, why there is so much bias against South Bay and San Jose. I didn't see any kind of dot over there. Three questions.
Let's see if I can remember all of those. Well, as far as past projects that have been characterized as studies, there's a table of recently completed and current projects in your staff report, which can provide some more information on those. I think some of the study projects, they'll take a bit of teasing out, but they include an enhancement study for Pilarcitos Lagoon. And I think the completed SEP that I mentioned for East Bay Mud, Stormwater, and Eddy Street Station was characterized as a study. I think those are the two that made up that piece of the pie. And then remind me, your second question was?
My second question, maybe we'll leave the last question first.
Let's see, education.
A state board education, that education should not be included in this SIP project. You did provide a small chunk of money, I saw on the chart.
for the educational
yes.
purposes.
Yes.
How is it possible?
That's actually a pre-policy project that had been carried over. So at this, that was one of those last transitional projects, and going forward you'll see nothing in the educational category.
That might be able to help, too, that we used to give a few thousand dollars to school programs and children to clean up the creeks and things like that, but that's come to an end because it was tough to follow up.
It was hard to, one, ensure that that had been implemented. The reporting was always a challenge on that. And two, it was also a challenge to say, what have we really accomplished? Right. Is there a nexus between the water quality violation and what we're doing? And I think the third aspect was, in many cases, those were small projects. We found that those small projects, small dollar amount, are difficult for both us as staff and the agencies to oversee them, that there's sort of a law of diminishing returns, and that's why I think that projects that are value less than $20,000 we're really not pushing to do because it's a lot of effort to put that together for something that's small. That money can still go into, or does go into, the cleanup and abatement account of State Board, and then we can potentially do larger projects as appropriate.
The other was the South Bay.
Yes.
And on the map over here, there is not a dot in San Jose.
There has been.
Yeah. I think there's one or two. I see one of those up there.
Yeah, Diane would like to make a comment to help.
That would in part reflect maybe the good thing is the lack of need for enforcement in the South Bay, since the locations often track with the areas where we have had violations and enforcement actions.
You've done a good job educating them down there, Dr. Singh.
Thank you. That question I was automatically because I live in San Jose. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Very good.
I have a quick question. Looking at what we have as current projects, the three categories, sewer, lateral improvement, restoration, and conversion to LID, track a lot of the comments and interests that have been expressed by this board. But I was wondering if you have either, personal ideas or whether people have been coming to you with ideas for future projects that do not fall in these categories that seem like good things to look at in the future?
And maybe the staff can answer this one as well, but I'll say that we do have a potential projects list, which at this point has, I think, about 80 projects of a wide variety of types on it. I think the preponderance of lateral improvement projects has tracked very closely to the enforcement focus on sewers, sewerage agencies, and doesn't necessarily predict the future. Is there anything that you guys would like to add to that?
I would point to the Rambaroo Island project as an example where actually we sort of brought the need by the sewerage agency of Southern Marin to address their administrative civil liability and a project that was evolving. We sort of brought those together as an opportunity to do a restoration, essentially right in Richardson Bay, where the violation had occurred and where the restoration project. And so it's trying to find where's the nexus, but it's also trying to find where are projects that are essentially ready to go. Because our experience also, and this is another reason doing the small projects is a law of diminishing returns, is that frequently we are dealing with nonprofits who say, hey, we've got a great idea for a project, but getting it from that great idea into something that can be an actual contracted out project and basically be accountable as Athena showed the template, saying that it's essentially ready to go. That's part of the challenge.
Thank you very much. I think, we're the board's working really hard to put you out of a job. That's a heck of an ironic way to look at things, but we're trying to make sure everyone does the right thing. But don't worry, there's always something out there. There'll always be there.
Yeah.
especially with this monitoring. We keep track of them a little tighter in monitoring. But I think that concludes our meeting at this point.
There is no closed session. I do want to remind the board that for the February 8th meeting, which is only three weeks away, that Chair Mueller will not be there, so we will be needing all of the other board members to attend to, you know, ensure that we have a quorum. So we'll look forward to seeing you in 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'll miss it. Yeah, thank you for the support.
Now that you guys...
Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure.